Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech and language pathologist. Whoops, sorry.
We're going there, aren't we? Hello, I am Kate Hensler. I'm a developmental interventionist with the First Steps program here in Louisville, Kentucky. How are you doing, Laura?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. It's sunny and 50. Can't complain.
I know. It's like spring, finally. I'm glad the calendar, the weather's going to switch since we flipped the calendar page, so that's great. Well, we are excited about today's show because we have a great guest with us who is a new speech pathologist in early intervention. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what kind of work you're doing, and then I think you have some questions for Kate and me, and we've just discovered that we know a speech pathologist. We have a common person that we all three know, so that was a real giggle fest right before we got on today. So anyway, go ahead and introduce yourself, Anne, and tell us about what you, where you are and what you do.
Okay. Well, I went to Ohio State University to get my master's, and I'm in Columbus, and I'm doing home-based early intervention therapies funded through the county. So I just get to go hang out with fun moms most of the time and their kiddos in the house.
That's great. And Kate had a great question before we started when we were talking about the show today. So, Kate, do you want to go ahead and just kind of start with that?
Well, she's already shared with you that you went to Ohio State. That's kind of hard for me to be too enthusiastic about, Anne, but that I don't have any preconceived notions about Ohio State. My husband went to Michigan, and he loves to hate Ohio State. So, personally, I don't really care about Ohio State. But in any case, I was wondering because, you know, I'm a DI, but I end up doing a lot of speechy sorts of things most of my days because I work with a lot of kids who are language delayed. So,
right.
But I often wonder as I cross paths with speech therapists, even veteran speech therapists, like, well, I wonder how much really direct education they get related to very young children. Because sometimes I see even seasoned professionals really trying to use the same techniques that they use with school-age kids with the babies that we work with, which doesn't really work very well, and I've never actually had the nerve to ask one of those seasoned professionals, so how much schooling did you really get? At one point, I went to nursing school, and, you know, we took, like, one class on PEDS, and we had one rotation with PEDS and didn't really do, as we did with every other specific kind of, you know, concentration. So I just kind of wanted to wonder, I'm sure Ohio State did a great job educating you, but just your personal experience about what, you know, how much you really exposure you had as a student and how that's kind of related to the real world and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, we didn't have too many little guys coming through, and I'm wondering if that's because we're not Ohio State, you know, the speech clinic at Ohio State, I don't think it's really under the funding you get for early intervention.
Right.
So it wasn't, you know, one of the options. So, you know, if you've got a kiddo under three, you're probably going to go with the free choice as opposed to spending money and taking into OSU. So we didn't really have a lot. We didn't really have any babies coming through. I think I had actually two of the youngest I did in. I remember distinctly I did an evaluation on a kid who was less than two, and I had one client who was, like two and a half, and I think those are two of the younger ones that kind of came through the system. So unfortunately, and there's not a lot of supervisors in early intervention out there that I've found who want to take students, you know, before they graduate.
Right.
So it's a shame because it's such a wonderful field, and I'm having so much fun, and I love it. And I feel, though, that Melanie, right at the beginning, really had to walk me through what to do.
Well, you have a great coach. I used to work very closely, as I do now, with Laura. She, at one point, was a speech therapist in southern Indiana, and I was a developmental therapist, they called us there. And she and I shared a lot of kids, just as Laura and I do. So I know that you have a great mentor.
Oh, yes.
And like Laura,
wonderful.
I think that Melanie has really, really, really good instincts. You know, I guess really my preconceived notion is that no program really teaches a therapist to be really good. That's kind of something they learn in the trenches and something they have kind of by instinct. You know, you have to get the baby thing before you can be a good baby therapist. So that's
right,
my
right.
preconceived notion. But so at this point, you're doing all 0 to 3 year old kids, or?
I have a couple older ones, but it's mostly because I picked them up just before their third birthday.
Okay.
So I didn't want their parents to have to, you know, try to scramble and find a new therapist or something. So I've kept them. But yeah, besides that, it's all, I think, mostly, you know, 1.5 and up.
Uh-huh. And how about as far as that was your clinical experience, you saw 2 kids under 3. How about as far as the educational approach? I mean, in the classroom environment, did they really talk much about what you do with a baby with language issues, or was that like one day of lecture, or, you know?
No, I don't know what Ohio State people might be listening to.
I know. That's what I'm thinking, too. I'm thinking, don't dig yourself a big hole, as I've been known to do on many occasions. Don't do it. We're not going to let you do that. Well, you probably got lots of theory, though, and lots of language development information. I think Kate's real question is, direct instruction?
Yeah,
with how you actually, what you actually do after you walk in a family's home, and you already have the eval done, so you already know they're delayed. Did you get a lot of therapy instruction where you're saying these are the things that work?
Right, and you know, and we went through, you know, different approaches, and we saw some videos and everything, but I think one of the difficulties is just that. And I don't know if any teaching clinic really has this, but we don't have any setup where someone's letting us go with them into a home, you know, as a student.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a different dynamic than what you get exposed to when you're in school. It's just it's hard to mimic anywhere.
Right.
So I keep telling, I'm hoping that Mel will just start having students go with her into these houses so that they can see what it's like, because I think it's really intimidating to start doing that, but it's such a rewarding area of practice that you could have a lot more people. And I know there's a shortage everywhere, but
I know.
Because the system is in place for speech language pathologists to have the work, and yet they're really educationally isn't necessarily the foundation. It's the same exact thing, by the way, for we developmental interventionists. It's like,
there's
a market out there. And what we end up doing is either getting an undergraduate, I got a master's in early childhood development, and honestly, I got a whole, you know, 36 hours of stuff that related to what do you do in a preschool, you know, what do you do in a kindergarten classroom, didn't have anything to do with what do you actually do if you're working with a baby in somebody's home. You know, we don't necessarily have circle time there, so it's really different, and there was really nothing that directly related, and yet it was the degree that the state of Kentucky said we had to get, so somebody thinks it's related, but really the educational foundation isn't really there for us either, so, you know.
Yeah, and I guess it's one of those things where it's kind of hard to figure out how to give that experience.
Right.
But I mean, we got a very thorough grounding in all of, you know, the norms that should occur.
Yeah.
You know, we know all of the stuff that they could teach us in the classroom. It's just finding, I guess, houses and people that want to take students into them.
Right.
And from my perspective, it really takes a lot of time and energy to have a student. Mm-hmm. And so I understand why a lot of speech pathologists aren't as, not willing's not the right word. How it would be, you know, it's kind of another job that you're doing.
It is.
You know, that you're not getting paid for or compensated for. You know, it's something that we do just kind of to mentor other people. And so I do see how it's a little bit challenging to find a supervisor who would want to do that too. And, you know, I had somebody ask me yesterday, did I have students through U of L, and I just kind of laughed it off and said, oh, I have a very full plate. Thank you so much for thinking about that, but no, sorry. Got a lot going on right now. So, I mean, even I do that, and I love to teach, and I love to talk about this job and you know, help other people kind of get further down the pike with that, but it is hard to kind of take that on. So that's kind of the other half of that. But But you were calling today to ask us some questions about kids on your caseload.
And the first one is actually about my son.
That was one of ours. I wonder if she has kids, so I guess we know that.
Yeah.
I do. We have one. He's 13 months old.
Uh-huh.
And it's something that applies to some of my other families because a lot of them, you know, have siblings growing up, you know, and they want to make sure they try to avoid any sort of language delays if possible.
Right.
And my son, I swear, I have done every communication temptation. I set up things right and left. And he's just kind of a quiet guy. You know, he'll babble sometimes. He'll say kitty till the cows come home.
Uh-huh.
But trying to get more out of him is so frustrating. And I'm sitting here thinking, I have an advanced degree in this area. And I'm looking in his little eyes. And I'm like, I don't know what to do to make you do this, mister.
Yeah, how's his comprehension? And is he waving bye-bye? I mean, is he following lots of little commands? Is he pointing to some body parts, going to get his shoes when you ask him? How is his comprehension?
No, he's not at the going to get his shoes part. But, you know, if you say kitty, he'll look at the cat. He'll look at mama, dada. He'll play, like, tickle someone. He's got, I'd say, okay receptive skills. I don't think he's, you know, lighting the world on fire in that
respect.
But, you know, they're there. I think he's understanding. He's definitely understanding much more than he's expressing.
Good. And so, but even like little routines, if you can say, oh, I think Dada's home, is he looking for the door and kind of anticipating those things? Or if you say, it's time for bath, do you see him move toward the bathroom like he's understanding those little routine things yet?
No, it's more single words, I'd say.
Okay. I would start with that, with making sure that you are so deliberate about comprehension, working on comprehension. And oh my goodness, this will be so good for a mom to hear this and hear that, you know, okay, just exactly what you just said. You know, I've got this advanced degree and I'm, you know, getting paid to help these moms with these other kids. But yet when it's your own real life baby, you know, it's different. It's totally different. And, you know, I think having my own children and kind of walking through their development made me so aware of kind of what it is to be in a parent's shoes, and it really made me kind of analyze the milestones and analyze what I was doing and analyze recommendations that I gave to parents. So you are getting the best education that you can right now by bringing up your very own baby, you know, while you're navigating your way through learning how to be a great therapist. I would work really hard on getting him to understand kind of those routines and respond to some of that so that you see him doing lots of anticipating and lots of following your verbal directions in the context of those routines. And those words are going to come as you build comprehension. You said he's babbling, so you know that, you know, he can produce speech sounds.
Oh, yeah, he is. And he's got a couple words, and he'll find more, and he'll do those things. And he's got, you know, if you say pick up, he'll pick up his arms. He's got a couple little routines.
Yeah, and I would just work really hard on building those. I would pump those little signs in. You said he's already doing more, so I would really expand that with kitty. If he likes that kitty and says kitty, I would go ahead and still teach him the word for cat and really, you know, teaching that. I would teach him other food signs work the best, even with that age. I don't know if you're letting him have a lot of junk, but...
It's his developmental strength.
Good. You know, but move on to some other signs about, you know, with cookie and cracker and fish, you know, whatever he likes to eat. I would move on with that, and I would do lots of those little, you've already said, you know, sabotage and communication temptations, and lots of hand over hand to help him get those little signs going so that you're setting up those expectations that, yeah, mommy really does expect you to do it. On the other hand, 13 months is really young, so I wouldn't be too worried at this point, but I would focus on comprehension with getting him to follow more of those directions and things in the context of your day, plus kind of bump up those signs. Kate, do you have some other ideas on that? We know Melanie's a player like we are. Melanie plays.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so she's taught you about that.
Yeah. Melanie's great. I mean, she has the knowledge base to help you in any direction. But I would say, I mean, does he do any back and forth, like vocalizing with you? Can you get him to, I have the best luck with kids who can be quiet at times with movement, like doing the ride a little horsey on your knee or whirling them around and wee. Can you get him to do, if he does that? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'd love to hear more.
Oh, well, I would just, say I'd like to see that he gets that vocal turn-taking stuff. And so, a lot of times my best effort is just to imitate what a kid does, whether it's a cough or a giggle or a, some kind of, excited sound. And just to really, really exaggerate, mommy's imitating you. You're kind of pretty much in his face with that big, excited look on your face. And will he go back and forth with that sort of thing?
He will.
Well?
Yeah.
I would say continue to build on that. Do you think he gets mommy's playing the game?
I think so. He's also very skilled at manipulating. Like, he gets all of the kind of, like, social games, kind of, like, social awareness things.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's played us many times already.
Will he do any animal sounds for you, Anne? Have you done any of that?
No, which is what I was, we were...
No meow with Kitty?
I know, it's just Kitty, although the kitties don't meow, it's more hissing, so I'd be okay with that.
Oh, well, fake it.
Yeah, totally fake it. And the easiest animal sound that I've found to get with a kid is panting like a dog rather than barking. I almost always get that first, where, we're talking about dogs and going, and then once they can do that one with you for several days, then try kind of a meow. And even if you're not doing an M-E-O-W, even if you're just kind of going, or some little noise that would be more similar, start with those little things and have them kind of try to imitate those. But lots of animal sounds. And kids at that age in that kind of 12 to 15-month range, that animal sounds, play sounds like uh-oh and wee and whoops, those things will kind of hook them more to imitate than I think real words will.
Right.
At that phase,
yeah.
That's where they are kind of developmentally. So I would do lots of those little things. Will you do a car noise or anything like that?
No.
When you're playing with him, with cars and stuff, he probably can blow raspberries. And so, just do a lot of little, with the cars. Start with those little things. And that, if you can make him noisier with those kinds of things, and as long as, like you said, he's got the social foundation, cognitively and receptive language stuff, that's chugging along too. So those things are going to come. You just got to kind of meet him where he is and do some of those more fun things kind of in addition to that. So that's what I would do.
That's great because, I usually get kids when they're about 18 months. So
right.
They're kind of, I'm still getting, the first words are still almost always like wee and uh-oh and animal noises. But they come quicker. It's just, I'm not sure what I should be expecting from him at his age.
Well, kids really should start to really build those words. And by 15 months, we want them to have those 8 to 10 words. Mm-hmm. And then by 18 months, we really want them to have about 15 words. I mean, the milestones. So you know where they are. And sometimes, especially kids that are just kind of quieter by nature, they may be a little slow to kind of hit those or might get them, the day he turns 15 months is when you might think, phew, we finally got that 8th word here.
It's under the wire.
Yeah, and some kids do kind of follow that developmental pattern, and that is crazy scary when you're a therapist because, you know those things and you're really worried, and at the same time you kind of feel a little bit like, okay, gosh, I should know how to do this. What's happening here? What am I not doing right? So
you can't be objective with your own kids. So.
You really can't. Oh,
and
my
God
gosh.
May bless you with the girl next who talks your bloody ear off. And thinking, what is up with this?
Please.
Yeah.
And it is harder when they're younger, though, like that, and they are just kind of looking at you like, I don't know what you expect me to do here. And Kate and I joke about all the time. We'll say, he's too little for me. That's the problem. He's too little. I need him at 2. I like it at 22 months, 23
months. 15, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I continually remind myself, the younger they are, the more true I think this is to be so repetitive. It's almost like, you know, they can attend to some silly little thing you're doing, at least with me, longer, more often than not, than I can stick with it. But so often I find if I'll just keep, if they're watching, if they're smiling, if they're, you know, engaged with the activity, and keep it simple, you know, like drop Belmo off the table and make him go boom 1,000 times.
And that's it.
Well, pop out, boom, on that 1,000th time. But so often I think, okay, I'm bored. I got to do something else. And if they're still engaged, that means they still like it, and you just need to keep doing it because he really needs so many repetitions before he's even going to think about, you know, and give him an opportunity to imitate whatever, but keep it so simple that he could possibly imitate not only, you know, the sound you're pairing with it, but the actual action itself. And I have to remind myself of that a lot, just to keep at it.
Me too, or I'll think, okay, I've modeled boom 25 times and he hasn't said it, so let me move on to say, oh, wait, he hasn't done that either. Let me try Elmo. Oh, no, he hasn't done that either. Let me try boo. You know, and Kate is right about just keeping it so repetitive and just picking one word that you're going to say over and over and over. And it does feel silly when you're doing it. You know, sometimes when
especially
I'm
when
doing
you have
it,
parents looking over your shoulder thinking, when are you going to make them talk? You know?
Right, right. It does kind of feel silly, and I have a new mom on my caseload who is, she is just the most darling mom ever, and she said to me, I saw him today for the fourth time, and she said to me the second time and the third time, I feel like an idiot. I feel so silly saying the same car, you know, and even to the point where, you know, like she said, I just think I can't say that word one more time, but I keep just doing it. And then when I went in this week, car wasn't one of the words that he said, but you know, she rattled off four or five things that he said in the course of the week that she's done now for weeks. But her mantra, when she would meet me at the door every week and I would say, how's it going, she would go, oh my gosh, this is hard, I just feel stupid saying the same thing over and over and over. But it really does pay off. That's great advice from Kate.
I love that. Yeah, that's good to hear.
Advice I give myself on a regular basis. Just stick with it, because it is, you kind of feel like, well, that's not catching, so I'll try something else.
I'll switch,
But really, then what you need to really pay attention to yourself is he watching? Is he smiling? Is he, you know, does he look like he's interested in this? If he is, stick with it.
Yeah.
Even if you think, I cannot do this again, you really can. And that means it's working, even if you're just getting a smile and a twinkle from his eye, it's working.
You know, and the other thing that I think it is really hard to play with kids all day long and then come home, and guess what? You get to play with another kid.
Yeah.
And that's hard. That's hard, but
you've
got to make yourself do it. What'd you say? I'm sorry.
I kind of get the B-team, the B-team play.
Yeah. I know, but you got to make yourself do it because it's so critical. And he is going to learn more in play. I mean, he's learning in his daily routines and everything, but really it takes that one-to-one mommy right there in my face, you know, for him to really start to do it. So, and again, easier said than done after you've seen five or six or how many ever other four kids in a day. That's hard to come home and play with your own baby too, but you know, that's where it happens. Yeah, it is.
But don't worry. When you do it long enough, it'll become so automatic that you could pretty much do it in your sleep. So, Sometimes I use sign language with my dogs. So.
And my kids have always said to me, please don't talk to me in that therapy voice. They can tell when I'm on autopilot. And they really could tell, you know, when they were still too old for that, you know, five or six, and I was trying to kind of go into my automatic routine, and they would, you know, really catch me on that every single time.
Oh, you love on that. Mother,
not
working.
Do
but
not use your therapy voice on me. Yeah, it totally will with the baby. Okay, did you have other questions for us, Anne, about other kids?
I do.
Good.
I've got a couple. Okay. So I have two, and when I picked them up fairly recently, they're like 19 and 20 months, so they're youngins too, and neither of them is pointing, and that was on their little report. That was like one of the major concerns. That neither of these children, you know, are pointing. And one of them, I'm not as concerned about his, I think he's got some other receptive language skills. Mm-hmm. And the other one, I'm not sure, I'm really not sure what he's thinking, ever.
Right, yeah. Like, or is he thinking,
it.
Yeah. That's a Kate line, yeah.
Hey! And so I can tell that he's looking at me and kind of like, I'm not sure about you. So with
right.
pointing, I mean, what's your opinion?
What other gestures is he doing? Is he waving bye-bye? Is he using any kind of like gimme-gimme fingers? Is he using any gestures at all besides not, you know,
he's really not. He'll sign more. I mean, I think most of the kids I see have gotten more by the time I see them. He'll sign
right.
more, and that's really the only gesture that I've seen.
Will he clap when he's excited? Will he imitate clapping if you're yay after he's done something? Will
he do
that?
I haven't seen it, but I don't know.
I would work on those other gestures too, with waving. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the show. You can make lots of things go bye-bye in the context of play. You know,
mm-hmm.
hide them under
yep.
your shirt, hide them under the couch, hide them everywhere. You know, do lots of waving and that kind of thing. Do lots of big animated gestures like when, and, you know, once you've waved bye-bye, you know, you can do the big, where is that? You know, where, oh, where is whatever, and sing your little song.
Right.
And do your big hands out for where. Even just copying something, like if you are playing balloons or something and having him hold his hands up, you know, in imitation of you to catch the balloon, or, you know, waving his hands or something like that. I would work on lots of other gestures and see if he can imitate those. And then, Kate, do you want to jump in before I talk about the other little thing about, you know, helping kids point?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Other things that when they are doing lots for their gestures, then you think, okay, this really is that he can't isolate his index finger. Will he isolate his index finger to operate a toy? Have you ever seen him do that, or is he still kind of doing a whole-handed
yeah.
thing?
No, he's got a button on a toy that he'll isolate his index finger for.
Okay, good. Well, then he can do it.
Yes.
So you've just got to...
It's physically possible.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and some kids can't. I mean, some kids really don't know how to, you know, then I'm always grabbing their fingers and smushing their hand together and then pulling that little pointer out, you know, for kids who can't do it. But if he can already do that, that's great. Then, you know, once he's doing lots of other gestures, you're just going to really, really model pointing. And you can do it with pictures and books and with puzzles and with toys, but I tell you, I get more success with teaching kids how to point with, like, a look or... You know, what's that? You know, a big gesture with pointing to kind of coincide with that. So if he's already isolating his index finger, you've just got to give him a reason to use it.
Okay.
And I think that you can, you know, do that with lots of other big gestures. Do you have any other ideas on that, Kate?
Sometimes I have luck getting kids using their index finger with popping bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a good one. I would say this. I don't know if you were asking this or not, Anne, but I kind of thought maybe initially when you were bringing up this particular child, you know, what's our feeling on that? I kind of wondered if you were asking, would you be concerned about 19 to 20 months you didn't point? Pardon me?
You know, how concerned should you be about the specific gesture or... It's one of those things. I mean, it was such a precise, like, mention in their evaluation.
Right.
You know, this is something we really need to target is pointing. And I was looking more globally. I'm like, well, of all the things and all, you know, the stuff we could be working on is really pointing, you know, would that be the first priority? Because I know I've read articles that it precedes language. So, I mean, do we have to get this pointing done before the words are going to start coming easily or?
You don't necessarily have to get the pointing done, but you do need communicative intent. So does he have communicative intent? I mean, that's usually why kids use pointing, is they're showing their moms what they want them to get them before they use words and things. So does he have that? I mean, is he going to what he wants and whining or somehow indicating to his mom that he wants something, or is she just kind of reading his mind?
I think it's more mind reading right now. I think he's starting to understand that there's an easier way to get what he wants.
Okay.
But it's just at the very beginning. I think
Yeah. You know, and I can't say that I work on pointing as a goal. It just kind of is something
I've never seen that before.
Right, but it's just something that you do kind of as another gesture or as another thing. You know, and you, I mean, you do, kids do need to be able to point. And, you know, and I know that, you know, we aren't huge advocates of, you know, working lots with books and having kids really point to pictures and books. But let me tell you, that's how we test kids' language. You know, when they get over two, especially, we're going to pop that little preschool language skill 4 right in front of them and say, you know, where's the ball? Where are the shoes? Show me the cookie. You know, so it is a developmental skill that they do need to be able to do. But I'm not so, as far as listing that as a goal, I would probably say, you know, use it kind of in the context of gestures, that he would use gestures to express his wants and needs.
No, and that makes more sense to me. I mean, it was just of all things to pinpoint. I'm like, why don't we start with?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you're kind of at the mercy of whoever did the initial assessment, and it may be that I think sometimes, and I've been probably guilty of this at a time or another, but sometimes that can be kind of code for, could this kid maybe be on the spectrum?
Right.
I'm not seeing any pointing. And they might, you know, along with he got excited and flapped his hands, or he, you know, limited eye contact. You know, there can be some kind of things stuck in a report that maybe kind of they're not going to say, gee, I suspect he could be on the spectrum, but they might give you a heads up about he did not maintain eye contact with me. He did not respond to my social bids. He did not point to anything I labeled for him, blah, blah, blah. So it could be, it could be I'm all wet, but it could be that she was kind of pointing out, I'm a little concerned here.
Yeah, I think there were some concerns in that area. So.
Yeah, and so maybe they are just kind of listing all the pre-communicative things that they feel like this kid doesn't have yet.
Right.
Right.
And I really feel like your instincts are right on that is pointing in and of itself probably the most important thing for that little boy right now. No. You know, I'm always, particularly, well, with any kid, and some kids you go in and this is totally intact and it's a done deal and you don't really even have to address it specifically, but you're certainly going to use the strength as you address other things, is that social connection. I'm guessing that guy doesn't have much.
No, and he got screened, you know, he went through a whole screening for autism spectrum disorder, and they came out like, we don't think so, but, you know, keep an eye on things, basically.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, I don't think he's going to have the strongest, he might not have the strongest social skills.
Right.
Right.
Which is, you know, something that we obviously are working on.
Right.
Right. And, you know, to do that, I would just do, like we were talking about the other things before, lots of little social games, you know, where you build routines where he has to really, where you kind of hook him emotionally. And, you know, he's going to want to sit on your lap to do Ride a Little Horsey, or he's going to want you to chase him and, you know, tickle, 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 and, you know, all those little things that build social skills. You know, that would be a big thing. And you can incorporate all those gestures in that. And with kids who don't have those kind of naturally little faces that light up and those connections, you do want to, you know, with those kids, I am over the top with what I gesture and, you know, how I use my facial expressions, because I really want them to start to notice those things. And so you can naturally embed gestures in those kinds of play activities. Don't you think so, Kate?
Yes. And I would focus more on, I mean, we talk about pointing being early, but really there are those things, you know, they know to reach to be picked up. They do a lot of kids instinctively do me, we call them gimme fingers, you know, where they're reaching and opening and closing their hands as if to say, gimme that. I think waving comes before pointing in my mind.
Yeah, me too.
And if they don't have those, I mean, I would work on those before I would ever really target, get that index finger out and use it, buddy. So
me too. And I would target, I mean, even clapping with yay.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be excited for a kid who's not really using many gestures at all, even though he's using more. And that is great that you've already taught him that. I would really want him to clap with you and get excited about stuff. And that would be something that, you know, in my, in my mind, I would think, gosh, I'm going to work really hard on making that, yay, you know, really, really fun, so that he would want to do that. And then when kids do get the waving and the clapping and, you know, do get an early sign like more and stuff, the pointing doesn't always come, but it usually, you're going to get close where they're reaching for things more. And, you know, again, you know that he physically can do it. You've just got to teach him the intent part now.
Okay. No, that makes sense.
Okay. Next.
okay, and this might be a huge can of worms,
okay,
but I've got another little guy. He's right around 2.5,
uh-huh,
and he's like uses a lot of jargon still. So
yeah,
he's doing great. He's getting, you know, some phrases. He's still using a lot of jargon.
Oh wait, I didn't mention that. Getting what?
He's getting phrases. He's got phrases.
Okay.
He still fills in jargon when he's around people he doesn't know, when he's in kind of uncomfortable situations.
Uh-huh.
He'll use more jargon then. And I don't think that we're missing a lot. You know, I think that it is jargon. I don't think it's words that we're not understanding.
Right.
We believe you on that.
Yep, we're with you.
We believe you on that, because I will go in meetings where, and the speech pathologist that's done the initial evaluation, we've really changed our system in Kentucky where now we have a primary level evaluator person do the initial 5-area assessment, and we don't assess kids until after the IFSP. And so I'll see the kid overdoing tons of jargon, and the darn primary level evaluator will sit there and say, well, We those are probably words. You know, we have to figure out, you know, you're going to need to do some kind of articulation test. And, you know, he probably has a phonological disorder. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? Those are not real words. That's jargon.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, Kate and I totally are with you on that, because that's a conversation we have routinely about kids. No way is that unintelligible speech. It's jargon. Yeah.
Right.
Well, then the behaviorist came in and threw out apraxia, which completely not appropriate. It's inappropriate for this child.
Right.
So the mom is great. She is wonderful. And I explained that he's not 3. Really, we don't use that term, you know, much before 3. And I really don't think that's a problem and this whole thing. But, I mean, I don't even know what it's like. How do I begin helping? I'm just stuck.
This is what I think. Since I did the DVDs and Teach Me to Listen and Obey 1 and 2 and just immersed myself in everything that I could read and understand and do and think about receptive language, I just almost always now associate jargon with receptive language problems. And that's not something that you're going to see written in lots of places, but over 2, at 2.5, when they have, I mean, does he have a lot of single words, or does he only have phrases?
He does.
You know,
he has single words and he has phrases. I mean, they're functional. He has what he needs.
Right.
You know,
But he just kind of lapses into that jargon when he's not sure what to say or what to do. Yeah, and I just almost always think that that's associated with processing problems, with I'm challenged here, and I know that I need to say something, but I don't have the vocabulary to say. Kate and I see it in kids that we've had several kids in our caseload lately that we share that, you know, those are kids that are talking that have, you know, basic vocabularies, and they even really like to hang on to those little holistic phrases. I did it, I got it, there it is, where'd it go? You know, all those little things. But yet they will kind of lapse into that, and we really almost always think about those kids as having difficulty with processing, with not truly understanding what's going on, with still struggling to kind of find the right word. They're kind of that default learner where they learn everything kind of as a chunk of information. And that might not be the case for this one particular little boy that you're talking about. But we see it a lot, and we talk about it a lot, haven't we, Kate, with those kinds of kids?
Yes. And I think that's kind of over time how I've come to see it too. How do you think his receptive skills are, Anna? Anne?
You know, I'd say, I think I did a Rossetti on him, and he's slightly delayed receptively. His expressive is definitely his weaker area.
Yeah.
But receptive still, I mean, it wasn't age appropriate yet.
Right.
Well, and that's the other thing, and it is, that is kind of hard to talk to parents about sometimes, but I wonder, you know, what you could do is just say, I want us to really make sure that he's understanding things and that he's able to, quote, unquote, process information. So with those kinds of kids, you know, you really do want to work on following multiple step commands. You want to make sure that you're still teaching them, you know, you're still really expanding that vocabulary so that they have the words to kind of pull in when they need it. I've heard OT say in meetings that the reason kids use jargon is because they have motor planning problems and they're apraxic and can't sequence the words that they need, but I really don't buy that because I really think about apraxia as a motor speech disorder, and they can't, you know, sequence, and so sequencing sounds is not his problem because he goes into blah, 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 you know, I can't even model, you know, I can't even give anybody who doesn't understand what we're talking about with jargon a good representation of what that sounds like because he sequences lots of sounds, you know.
It's long.
Right. Yeah, long
string. Sometimes those kids, you know, they can sing the whole happy birthday song or they can do, and how can you sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and be apraxic at 2.5?
Right,
you know, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but I think sometimes, and or you'll probably know what's making me say this, but I think sometimes those kids who present like he is with you today can sometimes kind of trick us, therapists, because sometimes they learn our routines really well, and they look pretty darn good, and you think, wow, this is really working, I'm thrilled, and everybody's happy, but then if you change this, and if you change your approach, or you change your routine, or you change something about the way it is you usually present it, because really we're pretty pretty repetitive because that's what works with these kids, but if when we do think to switch it or we change even just the circumstances that he could use the same language but doesn't, I think it kind of is a wake-up with, yes, he is doing great, but maybe not quite as well as we thought, you know?
That's exactly it. Honestly, I think that really just hit it. So.
Yeah, and we see,
you know, yeah, you're like thrilled because it is big. And also, as you're testing him and he's getting older, you're really kind of really, really, really upping the expectations as far as his receptive language skills. And a kid that can look pretty good at 2 because the standard isn't so high doesn't look as good, may not look as good at 2.5 or 3. And I think
with
our expectations increase, sometimes their receptive language skills do not keep pace if, in fact, receptive language is an issue. But I kind of think those ongoing jargon kids, I'm with Laura. There's probably a little receptive stuff going on there.
Yeah, and it may be hard to tease out. And so what you do for that is, and like Kate just talked about, is change your routine with him. If you always see him at home, have mom meet you at, I don't know if you guys do that in Ohio, but we can do community-based services where we meet him at McDonald's or a play, you know, a kid play place.
Yeah, we've actually talked about doing that just to try to shake things up.
Yeah, and that's what you do. Or you take in things that you know that he doesn't really like or you haven't done before, things that are totally new, you do that. Or if you just play outside with him versus playing inside with him, you know, if it finally ever warms up here, you know, so you do just change it so that you can get a better look at him. Does he go to preschool or anything? Could you see him at preschool? Or he stays home. Okay. Well, and that's probably a thing, too. And I think Kate probably just really did hit the nail on the head with that, is that he's just gotten to really know what you do and your routine, and so he does look better than he probably really is.
No, that's...
I've been surprised.
But it's good to hear.
Yeah. And, I mean, that happens to us. Kate and I just share a little boy that just aged off and just turned 3. And there for a while, we were thinking, woo, he's doing great. And then the closer we inched to 3, we were like, wow.
And it was, you know, it was a vast improvement, but yet it was, as he got older and we tried to vary things more and would see him with people he wasn't familiar and mom would relate situations at preschool or, you know, you just had to think, yeah, it is so much better, but really it still is an issue.
Right.
So I
yeah.
think if we get really good at teaching them our routines, and that's what we need to do, but then we need to kind of step back and say, how does he carry that over? You know, how
right.
does that look when you present it in a slightly different way, or you change your expectations, or and sometimes they don't necessarily perform the way you would have liked to have seen them perform, you know. It's like, oh, well, we're still closing that gap, so...
Yeah, and so just keep doing what you're doing because you know that he's making gains, but you do kind of, again, maybe change the place, change. You're not going to change your approach. You're just going to change the stuff that you use that you keep raising the bar and make sure that you're, you know, pumping in higher-level language and have him play different little processing games so that, you know, it's so funny to me, a kid that you can say, what's the cow say moo? What's the duck say quack? What's the... kitty say meow, and then you say, which one says meow? And they have no clue what you're talking about. Which one says quack? No response, like you've totally, you know, presented it in a different way. So that's the thing that I like to do, too, is kind of switch things up a little bit and, you know, look at what they already kind of know but ask it in a different way or, you know, work on it a little differently. I bet Melanie can help you problem solve with him with
she's wonderful.
Yeah, with specific things or specific ideas with the toys that you use or things that he likes. That might be something that you could really talk to her about and say, okay, I want to, you know, bump him up and work on some different things receptively. You know my toys, you know our routines. What would you do differently? And she can give you some different ideas there.
That's great. Well, I actually have to scoot. I'm going to go see a kiddo. So I'm going to have to. Thank you so much for letting me ask you guys some questions.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Melanie, I said hi. I need to Facebook or call her. We used to be really good buddies when she was here, and I miss her so much. So.
Oh, I know. I'm so glad she's here now, though.
Oh, and you'll have to tell her that you were on the show. Yeah, we asked Melanie to be on the show, but it was after she had had her last baby. Wasn't she taking a nap or something that day?
It was nap time and she forgot. I'm like, Melanie, I'll have to bug her again about that.
You'll have to tease her about that and tell her that we said that. Please give her a big hello from us. So
yeah,
nice
definitely.
To talk to you. And, Anne, I want to send you a couple of DVDs to thank you for being on the show today. So please send me your address so I can get those in the mail to you.
That's my way of saying thanks.
Thank you so much. Okay. You're welcome.
You.
Thanks.
All right. Bye, you guys.
Thank you.
Bye. Well, Kate, do you want to wrap it up and call it a day, or you want to just chat? Is there anything else that any other stuff you want to share with our regular listeners, follow-ups about any other kids we might have talked about or – a little intervention insight.
Oh, you're going to surprise me with an intervention insight?
Well, I already shared one from today that mom that I've seen, you know, just a handful of times, and she was saying, oh, I feel so silly. It just feels stupid to me to keep saying ball, 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 and, you know, that she's been working on ball. She's been working on bye-bye. He's a kid that loved the little fish-and-go-round game.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, and I said, okay, now he said this a couple times for me. This was a few weeks ago. You know, we need to be doing goldfish crackers. And, you know, he was already signing and sort of saying more. But now, you know, the whole time I was there today, popped out, wouldn't you know it, ball, more, bye-bye, and fish over and over and over. Because those are the things his mom has been so great about carrying over and being so repetitive and really kind of focusing on those. So that was my inner. Pause for choking. Yeah, that was my intervention insight for today. With that.
Well, I'm trying to think about intervention insight. Okay. It's not a great one, but I'll share it.
Okay.
That would be just a, for whether it be a therapist listening or a parent or caregiver, I guess parent would be more relevant. Those receptive kids, you know, she kind of toyed with that, or we kind of tried to point her in that direction with that jargon, 2.5-year-old talking, but
mm-hmm.
Still using a fair amount of jargon in unique situations. I would say to remind parents and or therapists who are on those teams to, because we had this come up too, to go ahead and make sure that if they have those concerns about their child or about the child they're working with, to share that as the child transitions on to the school system, because I
mm-hmm.
think that just as we said that we miss those things sometimes because kids can be
you know, look really good in some ways, and it's easy to assume, oh, he did this, therefore, you know, I can assume this. And especially kids who are verbal and are talking, it can be really easy to overlook receptive issues sometimes because you think, well, surely if he could say that, then he must understand this, and yet sometimes that isn't really always the case. And so I would say to remind parents and therapists the importance of sharing that as a kid is moving on to being evaluated with the school system or going on for therapy elsewhere, because in our world usually that happens, you know, between 2.5 and 3, and it's a good idea to give the next people who are going to be looking at that child a heads up about that, because I think now, just because we said that, and she'll be thinking about that more. She'll be looking
right.
at that more and
right.
concentrating a little bit more on that. And, I mean, it's
and
not
we have,
hard to miss.
It
know?
Is, and we have several kids. You know, you and I don't share the same caseload, but we always have 2 or 3 in common at least.
Right.
And, you know, we have that happen every year or so where we have a kid that doesn't qualify for continuing speech after 3 because he goes in and pops out one sentence or even more than one sentence, but a few little very well-rehearsed sentences or some jargon-like stuff that might have a real word or two at the end. And the speech pathologist from the school system says he's talking in sentences, he doesn't need speech, without really understanding that there's a whole lot of underlying stuff going on that she's really unaware of, and they do just kind of check them off. You know, I can think of, you know, I'm not going to name names because, boy, I sure don't want to get in trouble about violating somebody's privacy. But, you know, I mean, I can really think of several children that you and I have shared, and that's just on our caseload and our little part of the world that's happened with, you know, in the last several years. So it does really happen. So that's great advice. And that was not a good intervention insight to share. That was a great one to share.
Well, thank you. I do think it's easy to overlook with the kids we see, and it's certainly easy to overlook it in a one-time assessment situation. You know,
yeah.
You kind of make some assumptions based on what you see. And sometimes those are right and sometimes they're not. But that receptive language piece can be something that really, I think, hinders the child's educational experience as they get older,
mm-hmm.
may lead to some behavioral issues that, you know, if people understood, the child doesn't really understand the way you expect a child this age to understand, I think we'd be approach things differently if, you know,
right.
as professionals, if we really, really understand that, just as we understand that two-year-olds don't choose to not talk, if we knew he isn't following the rules not because he's being difficult, but because he doesn't really understand what I just expected him to do. I did not put it in a way that he could process it or understand it or really even
right.
respond to it. You know, I just think that's something that can stay with a kid in a very negative way when it's really not even been identified properly.
Right, and what you do for that is what we try to talk to Anne about, is that you really kind of up the ante in therapy with focusing on lots of comprehension stuff and lots of processing stuff. You know, you focus on following two-step commands because often, you know, those kinds of kids that are kids you just described, you know, looks like at preschool that he's tuning the teacher out when she's giving the long set of directions, where if, you know, she had broken the commands down and used, you know, 1 and 2-step directions versus telling him, okay, everybody has to put the Play-Doh away because we're all going to get ready to go to music class right now, so I want you to put your Play-Doh in there, and then I want everybody to go stand in the line by the door, and then I'm going to turn the lights off, and I want you to be really quiet while we're doing this. Okay, go. You know, and the kids that we're talking about lose her at, okay, everybody, I want you to, and they've already tuned out other than, clean up Play-Doh, go to the door, you know, that kind of thing. That we might have a chance of following that rather than that big, long set of directions. But what you really do in therapy, though, is start with making those comprehension and processing things a little bit harder. There's some good examples of that on my DVD, Teach Me to Listen and Obey 2, and there are also lots of examples about how to work on getting them to understand words beyond nouns or names of things. So there's a section there on teaching kids how to understand verbs or action words, teaching them how to understand those location words, which, you know, in English we refer to that as prepositions, teaching them to understand descriptive words, teaching them to follow two-step commands, and also a little section on how to make that really fun with games and little relays and activities that you can set up that are really, really fun for older two-and-a-half-year-olds, and you can even pull their siblings in and do some things and use their strengths that they already do understand to kind of build on those. So take a look at that. And Mom just sent me an email about Listen and Obey 2 that she just got and just watched, and her little girl is in the same situation because she said that she even tested within the low normal range on her when she had a speech evaluation. But the mom, you know, really felt like that the test, you know, that there were still some underlying deficits there, so she ordered the DVD and is working really hard on helping her shore up those things that she doesn't understand. So again, you know, that's another great example of a speech pathologist who really missed a kid who's struggling with that and who, you know, kind of, I think they kind of left the assessment thinking, wow, there's something wrong, but, you know, we didn't really find out anything specific about what it was because she scored within normal limits. So,
well, and I do think, obviously, that this woman you're describing is a very proactive mother who's going to, you know, she's going the extra mile, even on a kid who tested low normal. But it's those kids and sometimes kids who've had therapy that we've kind of taught them the test. We've taught them the game, which is great. But then they test a little better. You know, obviously that mommy's probably spent hours. Where's the doggy? Where's the horsey? What does the cow say? You know, all those little mommy games that lots of mommies instinctively play. And that's great. I'm certainly not knocking that. But then when you turn around and test those kids on that level, they look great.
They do.
Or,
and they really
look good, you know.
And the, yeah, and the kids who've been in therapy really know what a woman with a book and a bag of toys expects you to do. And so they do look better than they look at preschool or look at church or look in the grocery store or look at home when you're trying to go to a birthday party and you can't find the shoes and, you know, all the things go wrong and the five-year-old screaming and the, you know, three-month-old needs a bottle. And, you know, those kids look terrible sometimes in those real-life situations because it's novel and it's new and they're stressed. And, you know, those are the kids that that we do miss sometimes, and that's unfortunate. But maybe our conversations today and on the show in the past and on the show in the future, we'll clue more therapists and more parents into that, and we can help those kids with those underlying receptive language issues.
I do think it's something that becomes a little bit more apparent as they get older and older and older.
Yeah.
A lot of those kids go on to have some reading difficulties. You
right.
know, as we really raise our expectations, they don't necessarily keep pace with where they were at two because
right.
we're expecting them to understand more and more and more and more and more. And they may not always, if it's an underlying receptive language problem, may not keep with us. So anyway, it sounds like she'll pay a little bit more attention to that. And I know I have to remind myself to do that because sometimes I think, woohoo, and then I go, uh-oh.
Yeah, me too. Like, oh, let's not
still
be
have
quite
issues there.
So happy.
Still working on that.
Yeah, and I had a dad this week in a meeting say, great family, great, you know, I love this family, love working with them. But he said to his whole team of really perky early interventionists that we are, you know, sometimes maybe we need to do a little less cheerleading around here so that we get a full picture of what's going on and exactly, you know, exactly where this kid is falling. Because, you know, we do go in and we, you know, I think we all as a profession work hard to make families feel supported and make them feel, you know, like they're doing a good job and like their child is making progress. And then, you know, you do the six-month retest and the scores are horrible. And then that's when parents do kind of get a reality check. And so that was his point is, you know, sometimes we do need to pull it back a little bit and, you know, be really honest with where we are. So that was good advice for me, too.
Yeah, it's always hard to know.
It is hard to know, yeah.
I think maybe, I don't know, it was Greenspan or Rossetti, but somebody said, therapists always tend to say, that's really good, but we're still.
And I think that we do say that, and I think, and that's great, and I'm still going to keep on being that way. But sometimes parents don't want to hear the but, and sometimes we don't want to give it because we, you know, all want to feel good about where we are and stuff. You know, but we still need to kind of remind everybody and you know, keep an objective eye on the ball so that we all kind of know where we are. And that really does happen with these kind of kids, that they are talking and parents get so excited about the talking that you maybe underlook what still might even be a bigger problem down the road, which would be higher level processing and that those underlying receptive language things. So anyway, I'm glad we ended on that today. That's always important to remind ourselves and remind everybody who listens to.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much. Talk to you next week. Bye.
Okay, bye.